Today on Maine Calling, on the first day of spring, how to start from seed. First, the seed catalogs arrive in the mail. Then you start to see seed packets on display at the hardware store. Your fingers are just itching to dig into some soil. Maybe, just maybe, this is the year you'll start your seeds indoors and transplant the seedlings come May or June. But boy, last time you tried that, it didn't turn out so well. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and I can relate. Today on Maine Calling, horticulture experts join us to hold our hand and help us succeed at starting from seed. Whether you're hoping for hollyhocks or pining for peppers and parsley, they have tips. We'll also learn about sowing native plants from seed and seed swaps. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Planting seeds and getting them to grow into a full plant might seem simple, but it takes some know-how. Our guest today will explain how to do it right. Joining me, Emily Baisden, who is Seed Stewardship Director at the Wild Seed Project. Dr. David Handley, Vegetable and Small Fruit Specialist with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension, and Jean Pauley, who is a librarian and youth programmer with the Ellsworth Library, where she leads the Seed Library and Seed Swap. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you tried planting seeds to grow vegetables or flowers? What worked? What didn't? What are your questions for our guests? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I expect this to be a very popular program. Do not wait until the end to call or send your email. You may not get through. We often run out of time on our gardening program. So again, 1-800-399-3566. David, I'm going to start with you. It all seems so easy. We get the seed catalogs in the mail. We start thinking about those beautiful, speckled beans or multicolored peppers. And we think, okay, let's do it. We'll start this year inside. And we know a nice south-facing window, and that's where we're going to start. But that's not good enough, is it?
Often it's not good enough, actually. That is true. One of the reasons you're doing this is when we're starting seeds indoors, often these are plants that don't really want to be here this far north in Maine. And so the reason we're starting them indoors is because we don't have a long enough growing season. Our soils are cold, they're wet in the springtime. So we have to give them a head start to make sure we're going to get that lovely crop that you're talking about, because that could be just too far away in this short growing season that we have. So you do have to get them off to a good start by providing the warmth and other conditions that they need, or starting them outside, they're just simply not going to do well, or they're just not going to make it. So starting indoors, if you're a dedicated vegetable or flower gardener, is really the way to do it here in Maine for a lot of species. Not all. Some of them are short growing season. Like you said, beans will do fine if we start them outside, if you wait till the right time. But other things that we love so much, like tomatoes and peppers and some of our best flowering plants, they need that head start. So it's our job as gardeners to make sure they get it done right.
And what kind of investment are we talking about? How much should we expect to spend on, for example, grow lights or heat mats or things like that?
It really depends on the size of your garden. If you're just looking to have a few raised beds out back, you can do with a very simple setup, and you can probably do it for under $200 to have a really nice seed starting unit. If you're looking to grow a lot of things and need a lot of bench space to get these plants started so that you're going to have plenty of tomatoes for you and your family and for canning and so forth, now you're talking about a fairly big investment. But bear in mind, when you buy these things, they're going to last you for years. So if you treat them right, so if you spread that cost out over the number of years you plan to garden, it will work out pretty well for you.
Okay, and so what is your advice for a beginner? Maybe somebody who has a vegetable garden and is going to start small. Which plants are more, I'm trying not to use the word easier, but which are more likely to succeed than others? I'm guessing tomatoes are not the place to start.
Oh, tomatoes are
Oh,
not a
really?
bad start. And the reason I say that is because start with what you want to eat at the end of it. You're going to find that your level of dedication is much better if it's something that you really like and you want to see a reward at the end. So, if you despise eggplant but you think it's easy and you're going to grow eggplant, well, your enthusiasm just isn't going to be there. But tomatoes are popular. They're not that difficult. They do need to be started about 4 to 6 weeks early, and we can't plant them out until the danger of frost is past. So you have to do a little bit of work and math to make sure it's going to work. But overall, I would say, again, just go with your heart and say, this is what I really want. And then look at the basic instructions. There's some things that are, even though you really want them, they are especially difficult, and maybe you should put those aside and say, I'll do this once I have some experience and I get good at the simple stuff, then I can move on to the harder stuff. Things that seeds need special treatment before they get planted and so forth. Those can be a little trickier. But tomatoes, pretty straightforward if you got the right space and the patience.
Now, Jean, I saw you make a face. So you plant tomatoes from you start from seed, right? It sounds like that's one of your go-tos.
Absolutely. And just for those reasons that David said, you kind of go with your gut, literally, right? But yeah, tomatoes can be very forgiving. Again, provided that you're giving them the right light and the right kind of heat. I think a lot of people think that, they've got a windowsill and it's just not enough. You can do it, but it's better to, do a little bit of investment, get a grow light to get started. So my husband is a farmer up here in down East Maine, and he does all of his starts, even his tomatoes, in an unheated greenhouse with just a heat mat. So that's another option. You don't need to go for a full big greenhouse investment with a, furnace, a cranky furnace kind of thing. You can just do it with heat mats.
Okay, so we are talking about this because it's the first day of spring, and this is really a sweet spot to start a lot of seeds for your perennial garden or for your vegetable garden. Emily, it's a little bit late if you're looking at wildflowers and native plants for this season, right? But we've invited you because people will be thinking about next year. What is the best sort of way to think about getting your the wildflowers that you want to be on your hill or in your field going?
Yeah, thanks. It's funny. I started out as a vegetable and annual seed grower way back in the day.
You were
And
not old
one of
enough to
the
have a way back in the day, but go on.
things one of the things that I love to talk about is drawing those comparisons and differences between these, Mediterranean species, and the species that I work with now that are adapted to our main ecosystems. They're adapted to these cold winters and things like that. So many of the seeds and native plants and wildflowers that we have growing here go to seed in the fall, and they have adapted to really require these cold periods, these winters, the snow, the rain, the ice, because they have really, really thick seed coats, and those seed coats need to break down. So we find the best way to grow these plants and plant them out is to mimic what they need in the wild. So rather than growing them inside and starting them in warm, like careful, protected areas, we grow them outside so they can get those snows and freezes and thaws and break down their seed coat. Now there's several species that don't require a cold period that can still be planted now. Plants like bee balms, many of our asters, I still grow all of my stuff in the winter. It seems to be a nice time, especially if like now I'm starting to think about my vegetable garden. It's nice to be able to draw out your gardening year round. But generally, being able to plant these in pots and stick them outside gives them all they really need to be fully adapted to the growing conditions. And because they're mostly perennials, they do take a little bit longer. You're not going to necessarily get fruit in the fall, and you might need to do a little bit more transplanting and care throughout the growing season than you would for like an annual that's only going to be alive for a couple months.
Okay, well, let's talk about bee balms and asters, and would you start those right now, or in the next couple of weeks in the same way that you would start another kind of annual or perennial?
You could. I still find growing them outside gives them the best bet. It gets them really adapted to their growing conditions
Okay.
right away.
So you would
One of
stick
the
some seeds in a pot and stick it out on the deck.
The biggest thing you want to do is protect them from birds and rodents and things like that that also really love to eat seeds. Seeds are a really important part of our ecosystem, and food webs, but having some sort of window screen or something like that over your pot and then just having them outside, getting those conditions will really have them growing and adapted. You can still grow them inside. They might grow a little bit faster that way, but then you still are going to want to plant them out in the world. So they're going to want to feel colds and harden off the same way you'd harden off a vegetable.
Jean, one of the problems with seeds is that packs come with a lot of seeds, and most of us have a small garden and maybe want five tomato plants or three pepper plants. That's where seed swaps come in, right? Tell us about what happens at your library, at the Ellsworth Library.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly how we came upon the idea of seed swap is, sometimes you get to your seed packet, you have these extra seeds, and so maybe you'll save them for the next year and the next year, and then, at a certain point they're not viable anymore. So seed swap is a nice way with those extra seeds that you have, you can bring them, and so somebody else might just find that's exactly what I want to grow, and I need those extra five seeds to get going. So it's a really nice way to kind of share that.
When do you do that?
So our seed swap is actually tomorrow, March 21st, between 10 and 1. And we're going to have a story time from 10 to 11. So if you want to bring your kiddos to get kind of excited about planting seeds, we're going to be doing a seed paper craft, which you take, it's called a wildflower mix, but they're actually mostly annuals. And then you mix them with like a paper pulp, and you create this little thing that you can plant as well.
All right. Well, David, I want to come back to you and talk about seeds from year to year. Lots of people have seed packets that have been in the garage that are a year, 2 years, 3 years old. Should we throw them away or give them a shot?
It depends on your level of tolerance. If you're willing to understand that when you seed those, they're not all going to come up, and some of them may not come up, and you have a backup plan, then go ahead. Because if they've literally been in the garage and the seeds have been exposed to real dry conditions, they've been exposed to humidity and moist conditions, there may have been some germination, and they may have froze, and some seeds won't tolerate that. So the best bet is to either start with fresh seed every year, or if you want to save seed, understand that that seed needs certain conditions in order to stay alive. Remember, seeds are alive, they're living things. And unless they have correct conditions, they're not going to be able to survive. So usually the best thing to do with your leftover seed, if you want to try to grow it next year, is keep them in the seed packets, maybe put them in a sealed container in your refrigerator, not in the freezer, in the refrigerator. And give them a little shelf space back there. And then when you take those out next year, they should be in good shape. Most seeds will last more than a year. That's why these seed swaps work pretty well. But some seeds are less sensitive. For example, carrot and celery seed doesn't tend to last very long. You're lucky if you get good germination the following year. Pumpkins, most of the cucurbit crops, pumpkin, squash, and so forth, you might get 2 years out of them. Other seeds will last a long time. Any of your crucifers, cabbage, and things last years and years if they're held in the right conditions. So it's important to understand what they are and to treat them right. And yes, you can store seeds and they can last for years and years. But as you said, if you find something in the back of your garage and that's 3 or 4 years old, I probably wouldn't do it. If I did, I'd seed it really thick and hope that a bunch come up and I can transplant them out, and keep the survivors.
Okay. Well, Emily, I want to ask you about wild seeds a little bit more. Those that perhaps you're thinking about, either you started last fall or thinking about for next fall. Somebody might say, wait a minute, if they're native plants, can't I just toss the seeds into a meadow? Won't they take? I mean, the whole point is that they grow naturally.
Yeah, great question. It's probably the number one question I get. And there's a few points with this that are important to understand. And a lot of it, once again, goes back to mimicking and understanding what happens with seeds in the wild and in their natural environment. Plants are a group of individuals that produces a whole lot of offspring. And generally, that means most of that offspring in the wild isn't going to go become a living, reproducing adult plant. So that's why we encourage people to not broadcast their seed, because most of that seed is likely going to get washed away, eaten by birds or rodents, or just end up not in the conditions needed for them to be able to grow and break their dormancy. Now, you can broadcast seed. The best way to do it is to have a truly prepared site. So if you're just going to sprinkle them in your lawn, that's really not going to work because there's already grass, and grass is a really aggressive plant. And a seed isn't going to be able to compete. There's not going to be able enough open ground for them to be able to germinate. So first you would need a truly blank slate to be able to put your seed on, and you'd need a lot more seed. And the cost becomes fairly prohibitive when you get to talking about this much seed. You're talking pounds of seed to be able to spread out. Because, like I said, most of that seed isn't going to then become an adult. And I find that that's why we encourage people to grow them in pots. You can kind of remove some of those variables that would kill a seed. You can keep them contained in the pot. You can cover them with that screen so rodents can't get into them. And you can use way less seed. I can grow 100 plants in one pot. Of seed that if I had scattered those 100 seeds out into my lawn, I'd maybe get one plant out of it.
Oh, wow. Are there some beginner native seeds to turn to? Some that, boy, the first time you try, you're probably going to succeed.
Absolutely. And I always go back to the asters. They're such great beginner seeds. You can really plant them anytime from fall through April. And they tend to come up really, really well, and don't need too much babying. And what I love about them is that there's so many different species out there. There is something for every site condition. I talk a lot about right plant, right place. Rather than trying to amend your soil to fit the plant that you want, there's always a good plant that will fit the soil that you already have. And asters are a really great poster child for that. Plus, they're really, really important for our pollinators.
All right. Well, we are talking about starting from seed. This is our first gardening show of the season. It is the first day of spring. What are your questions? 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're learning about germinating seeds, what plants to grow, and why native plants offer diversity to the environment. Joining me, Jean Pauley, who is an organic farmer and she works at the Ellsworth Library, Emily Baisden with the Wild Seed Project, and David Handley with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Share your comments and questions, especially your questions. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Maddie Whaley, who's with the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. She is Education Programs Coordinator. Maddie, earlier in the program, Jean told us about the Ellsworth Library seed swap tomorrow. You have a seed swap and more on March 29th, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So, yeah, March 29th in Unity, Maine, from 12 to 4, we have a big seed swap, typically sees a couple hundred of people. Yeah, and we're looking forward to it.
And is it just seeds or is it seeds and seedlings?
Yeah, it's It's a variety of things. So we call it the seed swap and scion exchange. So there are a lot of seeds of all different varieties, so like native plants, flowers, veggies. And then there's also scion wood, which is clippings of typically fruit trees that you can graft onto roots of other fruit trees to propagate more fruit trees. And people will also bring in starts, so vegetable starts that they've started at home, and houseplant cuttings and things of that nature.
So Maddie, how organized is this? I'm trying to picture how this all works. Is it a free-for-all or is there an auctioneer? How do you do it?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a free-for-all, but we try to keep it as organized as possible. So we have volunteers. So when you walk into the space, you'll see a bunch of tables set out, and on one side of the room, you'll see the scion wood that I was talking about earlier, those fruit tree clippings. And on the other side of the room, you'll see a bunch of seed packets. And we have a bunch of volunteers and staff who try to help keep things organized by type of seed, by for scion wood alphabetically, and help do intake and labeling for any seeds and scion wood that community members are bringing in to share. So that's kind of how we try to keep it organized, but all community members are welcome to just kind of go up to the tables and, you know, respectfully and with keeping in mind, you know, the many other people who are also there to grab some seeds and scion wood, they can take what they need for their garden.
Well, Maddie, thank you so much for calling in. Maddie Whaley with the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association talking about their seed swap extravaganza on March 29th. Jean, I'm wondering, is this sort of a new trend to have seed swaps?
Well, I mean, so this is our third annual that we've done here in Ellsworth. And I actually used to live in the southern part of the state, and we started doing seed swaps a few years ago. But I mean, I'll be honest, I took a page out of Mothka's book because I had attended their seed and scion swap, and I just thought it was such a good idea. And it's just something that I think it's really good to bring that kind of thing locally, because not everybody can get down to Unity from where we are. And so we've got our seed swap here, and I know there's other ones in other parts of the state. So it is really nice. We have some really great volunteers. We've got members of our own master gardeners. We also have Native Gardens of Blue Hill that are going to be there, again, to answer questions for folks. Yeah, so it's great.
And I'm sure there's all sorts of just groups of friends who get together to swap seeds as well. I'm going to go to some questions from the audience here. An email from Patricia. I have used my own human heat pad versus a heat mat as a method to keep soil warm. Is that kind of dangerous? And also, can I start my dahlia bulbs indoors and transplant outdoors when the soil outside is nice and warm? I'll turn to you, David.
I'm not sure what we mean by the human heat pad.
Like, I'm thinking, you know, the kind that you use, that you've bought at the drugstore.
Right, like when you have a tummy ache kind of thing.
Yeah.
I went a whole different direction there. Okay. generally, we would not recommend that because those things are going to get wet. And those heat pads are usually not designed to handle much in terms of moisture. So you could run into some problems with that. So that's why the heat pads designed for this are usually rubber or plastic, and they can handle that water. And they can also handle the fact that they're not between sheets or something like that. They're going to be experiencing a lot of difficult conditions themselves. As far as the dahlias go, as far as I know, yeah, you can start them inside. If you want to get them flowering earlier, that's fine. No problem with that at all. Just make sure the pot's big enough and you keep that media warm and wet to get them up and going.
All right. An email here from Bruce. I just got my first order delivered for Canada Lily, Lilium canadense, from Wild Seed Project. This is the coolest lily I see out and about. It will be a challenge to get them going successfully, but the reward will be lasting. Emily, any advice for Bruce?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I'm a big fan of lily seeds. If you ever get a chance to look at them, they're beautiful, sparkly, gold, papery seeds. I find lilies are one of the trickier plants to grow from seed. They like to have a warm period followed by a cold period followed by another warm period to be able to germinate. And it can take up to 7 years for them to actually be of flowering age. So they're a real test in patience. I
Did
find
you
I
just
get
say
the
7 years?
Yep, yes. Many of our long-lived perennials may be small, but they live for quite a long time and it takes them quite a while to become reproductive adults. Lilies are one of those that can take quite a while. And a lot of that is because a lot of what they're doing is building up bulbs underground. So they're putting a lot of energy into their underground growth before they start putting energy above ground. So I find growing lilies works best in like crates. I really like old bulb crates. You can usually get them pretty discounted from garden centers. And filling them with soil and sprinkling your seeds in there, and that will give plenty of room for those plants to start creating their little bulbs underground, and they'll start creating little like pips. They're pretty cute. So after that first year of warm to cold to warm, you can kind of dig down and start seeing things happening underground. And the biggest thing is to not forget about them because it is that long-term growth. Occasionally, you'll start to see some little green coming up, but you're not going to see big stalks for a couple years, probably.
Okay, here's an email from Edward. Is there any expertise in Maine on growing potatoes from actual seed known as true seed potatoes? Jean, is this something you know about? You said your husband's a farmer, but that's not something he does. David,
No,
go ahead.
generally just tubers, yeah.
David, go ahead.
The University of Maine, of course, has a breeding program for potatoes, so you may want to contact the plant science department up there. There are a couple of people who do that. And in fact, there's one person in the Waldo County Extension Office, I believe, Brett Johnson, who also helps with that breeding program. But potatoes are typically propagated vegetatively. We just use parts of the tubers underground to propagate them that way. And that way, you're sure that the potato you're planting is going to be the same as the potato you dug up and enjoyed the previous year. When you're growing them from seed, you really don't know what you're going to have, because that pollen usually comes from a different source. But you have two parents involved, a mixture of genetic material, and it might be a good potato, it might be a total bust. So that's typically why we don't do it from seed. Also, the seed's kind of hard to harvest because that fruit doesn't mature until very late in the season, and often won't get to a mature point here in Maine. We do most of a lot of the breeding work and seed work happens down in Florida, even though our program is in Maine.
An email here from Barbara. When I was a child, my mom always said seedlings should be transplanted before they start to flower, allowing the seedlings to focus energy growing bigger and stronger before supporting flowers. That this promotes bigger plants and more blooms throughout the season. All the seedlings I see for sale these days are already in bloom. Does it still matter? David, I'll go back to you.
The reason they're in bloom when you go to the garden centers is because people are going to buy them. You buy with your eyes, and when you've got those big flowers there, you can't help but grab a tray and pull out your wallet and pay for them. But the fact of the matter is that for a lot of species, the length of the bloom is going to be longer if you start them before they start to flower. So if you want that flowering throughout the season, then it's probably better to get ones that aren't quite in flower yet. The other caution I would note is, especially if you're one of these people who comes in late in the season hoping to grab stuff on sale, you'll see things in flower. And oftentimes that's because the plant is very stressed. And when you have a stressed plant, it's been experiencing drought or it's too crowded, the roots are getting all bound up in those teeny little pots. Its response is to try to reproduce really quickly and get my job done. And if you take those plants home, they will never perform for you. They're going to be very sad and unhappy. And it's very doubtful that they're going to come back and put on that profusion of flowers that you want so bad.
An email here from Rob. We are trying to rewild our property and looking at native pollinators. To avoid pesticides like neonics that are harmful to bees, pollinators, and birds, we look for organic or at least non-GMO seeds. Can you tell me the difference between these two? Emily.
So organic seed is going to be a seed that is not treated with inorganic pesticides, which pesticides include herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides. GMO is going to be a genetically selected crop. So sometimes those might be treated, but they're going to be two distinct labels. Generally, definitely avoid pesticides. The whole point for us trying to grow these native plants for wildlife is to feed the bugs. I always like to note that even organic pesticides are still pesticides. So they still are going to inhibit insect feeding. So be aware of that. So even using things like neem on your native plants is going to stop the bugs from eating them. When it comes to GMOs, that's more for breeding for a specific trait, whether it be yield or resistance to herbicides or things like that. So they can be connected, but they're pretty different in the end.
An email here from Jennifer. One way to determine the viability of your saved seed is to conduct germination tests. It's a fun February activity. You put 10 seeds in a damp paper towel in a Ziploc bag. Keep it in a warm place and check it after 5 days, then 10 days. Keep notes on how many of the 10 germinate. I mark the germination rate on the seed envelope. Then when you plant your seeds later, you know what germination rate you can expect and plant accordingly. Jean, that sounds like a fun activity for the kids you work with at the library.
Yeah, it is. It is a fun way. You know, you kind of get to see how the seeds, you know, open up. You get those first roots coming out, and it's a great thing to do with kids. And again, when you're getting seeds at the seed swap, if you get a packet of seeds and you just, you know, there's a whole bunch in there, you can take a few and just put it on, you know, put it in that paper towel, and just see how they do before you go through that investment of planting them in a little pot with soil and then kind of waiting and kind of being bummed out if it doesn't turn out. So the germination test is a really good thing to do.
Jessica says, I'm not sure this is relevant to today's discussion, but I'd love to hear some recommendations on how to best rid your yard of invasive plants, including multiflora rose, bittersweet, and Japanese barberry. I'm really struggling with this. I'm asking the question, Jessica, because this is, pardon the pun, a perennial question on Maine Calling. And why not start now? Why not start now thinking about it? David, I'll go back to you. It's March 20th. Is this a good time to get at it?
Oh, absolutely. If the ground is thawed out enough that you can, when you're doing your, put on your gloves and start pulling out, get as much of that root system out as you possibly can. So late fall, well, really anytime, early fall to early spring is really the time to get in there, because this is when the plants are most susceptible, because they're depending on the storage organs, those roots and so forth, to really push them through. If you try to do this late in during the summertime, most of the growth is heading in the other direction, and you can yank and pull and you're still going to get sprouts from the roots and so forth. So it gets really frustrating. So I would say, now is a good time to go and do it.
And when you say this, to go do it, is going, does that involve getting a shovel and trying to dig it up? Does that involve getting some cardboard and covering up the patch and trying to solarize it? What would you be doing if you had these difficult invasive plants?
Depends on the plant. Usually what I would do in this case is this time of year, as I said, if the ground is fairly friable and you can get as much of that root system out as possible, that's fine. When you start seeing those sprouts breaking from the bits of root that you missed it, that's the time to cover it up with a good thick tarp and put some rocks on it so it doesn't blow away. And that will, these weak seedlings that are coming up from what you left behind are going to be much more susceptible to getting cooked under that black plastic than if you just try to put it over the existing plants that are there now. They will usually find a way to crawl under it and pop out the other end of the tarp. So both of those techniques work. And what I would suggest is you combine the two to give it a 1-2 punch. And that will help.
Emily, I see you nodding. I suspect lots of people who want to introduce native plants to their yard also want to get rid of something else first.
Yeah, absolutely. And first step is to get rid of things and make some space. And I echo what David said with it depends on the species and using multiple tools in your toolkit. One thing that I always like to tell people is to remember to take a breath and not get too overwhelmed when you see these like large swaths of land with biodiversity inhibiting plants. And to take that step back and think about invasive species biology and understand that You're not necessarily looking to fully eradicate something. You're trying to bring back ecosystem functioning. You're trying to reestablish biodiversity in an area. So taking it slow and taking small parts and being able to see that changeover rather than trying to clear a whole swath of land at once. You're actually probably going to do more by clearing small spaces, replanting them with natives, and going section by section and bringing back a little bit of biodiversity while you do that rather than trying to clear cut a bunch of stuff.
Kind of the patchwork quilt strategy. We are talking about gardening, specifically starting from seed, but we will take any early spring gardening question. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are learning about germinating seeds, what plants to grow, and why native plants offer diversity to the environment. Joining me for the hour, Jean Polly, who is an organic farmer and works at the Ellsworth Library, runs the seed swap there, Emily Baisden with the Wild Seed Project, and David Handley with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. David, I'm going to ask you kind of a big question before we go back to the calls, which are streaming in. Why start from seed? Why not just get some seedlings in a couple months?
Well, some of us like the challenge, of course. That's a big part of the whole gardening thing. But one of the reasons that I do it is because you get a lot more choice of what plants you can get a hold of and grow. There's a lot more diversity in the seed catalogs than you'll find at the garden center. The garden centers are going to select for the ones that they think they're going to sell the most of. And especially if you're into some things that are kind of unique, native stuff, for example, you may find that really your only source is to start from seed. So that's really the number one reason why I like to do it, but also just because you may be able to do a better job in the terms of the plant quality that you're looking at. If you get good at this, you can produce plants of a quality that are going to take off and do very well in your garden for you and not have to suffer with stressed out plants that are left on a bench someplace because you got to the garden center a little later than everybody else. So quality and selection is really the two good reasons to get into it.
And Emily, I saw you nodding. Many local garden centers are a lot better than they used to be in terms of carrying native plants, but you still have more selection if you go from seed, right?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked this question because I just want to gush about how amazing seeds are for a minute. Because for me, the major reason that I like to grow these plants from seed, it comes down to diversity. We know diversity leads to community stability, and the same thing goes for genetic diversity. And when we're working with seeds, we're working with what's called open pollinated plants. So every single seed is going to be a genetically unique individual. They're the embryonic stage of the plant. So each seed is going to be genetically unique. Whereas when we go and buy plants from the garden centers, a lot of them are reproduced clonally, which is a really easy way to get a lot of large plants in a short amount of time. But they're going to be genetically identical to whatever the mother plant is. And we know when we have higher genetic diversity, it leads to higher adaptability, more likelihood of resilience, more likelihood of adaptation towards things like pests or disease or climate change. So that's why I really, really love working with seed, because each individual plant that comes out of each seed is going to be a little bit different and a little bit different adapted, and it's going to be better for our biodiversity and our bugs and our birds and our animals.
We'll go to Laura, who's calling from Gorham. Hi, Laura. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm developing a 6-acre property that I bought in 2018, and I got to a certain area of it. I'm just sort of, there's trees and woods and stuff on it, and I'm just sort of planting things where I can and leaving it mostly natural. But in the past couple of years, pokeweed has started infesting a certain area of it. I believe it's pokeweed. It's sort of like has purple berries, and it gets super tall, like 7 feet tall. And I'm wondering, A, if there's a better way to get rid of that or reduce it, and B, can I plant anything if it exists and it's encroaching on every other thing around it?
Okay, who wants to take this one? We have
I can
three.
Go first.
Go ahead, Emily.
David has some things to say as well. Well, first, pokeweed is a native plant. It's actually a really, really great plant for birds. It tends to fruit at the time. A lot of birds need that type of nutrition. So if there are places where you're okay with keeping it, it's fine. It's not a bad plant for the environment, though it does have a very deep taproot. So it can be hard to dig up. They don't transplant well because of that. So you really want to try to find them when they're younger, and you can really get a shovel down to get those taproots out to be able to fully remove them. And that's really your option. If you don't want them reseeding a bunch, just cut them back before they can fruit, because once they fruit, the birds will be going for them and eating them and then spreading them all over your property.
Laura, thanks for your call and good luck to you. Let's see, we'll go to another Laura. This Laura is calling from Lincolnville. Hi, Laura, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. I've got a new site build in a forested lot with a bare area that I wasn't able to get seeds down on before the winter. I'm looking to figure out a cover crop or some kind of low maintenance grass or clover seed that I can put down while I plan for planting it with natives and species that like to be in the forest, but where we can also have it be like a functional yard for our home. I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for something that can be more easily replanted with native species over time, but that's also going to lock in some nutrients into the soil, prevent water runoff, and stabilize the earth at this time of year.
Okay. David, would you recommend clover?
Clover's fine. It will help build the soil. I think if she's looking at this as a temporary arrangement, remember clover is perennial and it actually can become difficult to get ahead of once it gets itself established. What you may want to look at is something like a mix of oats and cowpeas, which will provide you with a grass that will give you the cover and erosion prevention. The peas will provide some nitrogen to the soil and have deep tap roots to help improve that soil structure. And this is one that will pretty much kill over the winter time. So you don't have to worry about trying to kill it yourself, or you can mow it real close and that would pretty much kill it. And then you can go ahead and get the natives established that you want to get established. So something like that would work. But before you even put that seed down, you'd probably want to have a soil test done to make sure that there's a level of nutrients in the soil pH is where these cover crops are going to be happy, because you don't want to spend all that money on seed and then have it fail because the soil's not in good condition for it.
Yeah. And David, when you go to have a soil test and you send off your sample to the UMaine Cooperative Extension, you want to dig pretty far down to get that sample of soil, right?
Well, again, think about what you're planting. So if you're planting just annuals in a garden space, then you really only need to go down 6 or 8 inches. If you're talking about a shrub or a tree, then yeah, you should go down at least a foot and try to take that whole soil profile. So what's represented in your sample is the top all the way to the bottom, and mix it up in a bucket. And then you put that in the little box that the soil analytical lab gives you and send that up. And don't just pick your soil from one little spot. If you're going on a big area, you want to move around that area and try to get a representation of the whole area. Mix that whole bunch up in a bucket and then take your sample from there to go up to the university.
Oh, that's an interesting question, because I'd always wondered, do you send in several different soil samples? And, you know, this from this part of the yard and this from this part of the yard?
If one part of the yard is significantly different in terms of what is growing there, and, or this part of the yard is sandy, this part of the yard is clay, then I would definitely take different soil samples. But if the ground itself is fairly uniform, then one representative sample from that area will work.
All right, Laura, thanks for your call. An email here from Maura. How to collect and store seeds for next season or year replanting. Jean, is this something that you do?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because one thing I did want to touch on is seed saving. So when Emily was talking about all that beautiful genetic diversity and I was thinking about the idea of saving your own seeds, and there are some seeds that are easier to save than others. But it's, you know, if you're growing an open pollinated variety and there's, you know, there's one plant that's doing particularly well, you can save the seeds from that plant. And different plants have different requirements for what they need in terms of where they need to be in terms of maturity, and how they want to be, you know. Tomatoes require a little bit of an extra process to save, but beans, you can just kind of pop them out of the shell. And again, you can save them from year to year. And that's another thing that we love to see at Seed Swaps is people bringing seeds that they've saved from their own gardens. But yeah, I think David also touched on the idea of, you know, keeping them in a cool, dark place, you know, so once you, if you have saved your seeds and they're, you know, they've dried out and they're at a place where you can store them, make sure they're labeled as well as you can with as much information as you can, you know, gather, because, you know, the end of the season is always harvest time and you've got, you know, a pile of tomatoes here that needs to be canned. And sometimes the last thing you're thinking about is, you know, writing down all the information for a particular plant or a variety that you're saving. But again, you know, keeping as much data as you can is really helpful.
And Jean, I want to go back to what you said about beans. I'm guessing that this is a really good use for those beans that got too big, that even though you're trying to find them all, it's really quite an interesting treasure hunt every year, isn't it? No matter how careful you are, there are always those that get sort of a little too big to be tasty.
Yeah, those are the ones that want to be next year's beans, you know, and especially if it's a plant from a bean that you really enjoyed eating, definitely save those seeds. And if you have extra, bring them to the seed swap.
We'll go to Bill calling from Agunqua. Oh, I'm sorry, David. Bill, hold on. David, go ahead.
I just want to caution that when you are saving seed, this is obvious to experienced gardeners, but you don't want to try to save seed from hybrid plants. So if your tomato lists that it's a hybrid or your corn is listing that it's a hybrid, these, because the two parents of that offspring are very, very different. And when they get pollinated by an outside source and you're collecting that seed, you have to understand that the plant coming from that seed is going to be very different from what you had last year. So as Jean said, open pollinated plants, generally that's all going to be fine. But if on the label your favorite variety happens to be a hybrid, you're probably not going to be successful saving seed from that.
Okay, we'll go to Bill now calling from Agunquit. Hi, Bill, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I have a different type question. Last year I was unfortunate to have moles and voles invade my flower garden. And I noticed with the snow melt already that I see some vole little paths where they've, you know, pushed the dirt aside and burrowed under the snow. So I'm looking for tips or advice on either natural way or products that could help me eliminate these critters.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you for calling. This is also a perennial question. People don't like moles and voles, but they also don't like grubs, right? So what's your advice? I'll turn to you, Emily.
Oh, yeah. So I try to take an approach of learn to live with things, but doesn't work so well when you're doing vegetable gardens that you want to be able to feed off of those plants as well. And yeah, I think there's an important distinction between moles and voles. Moles are mostly eating grubs, so they're not eating roots. They are creating pathways and things like that that can disrupt roots, whereas voles are actually eating vegetables and moving around and can kill a crop. There's, you know, a lot of fencing that can be done if you really dig down. Generally, I find try to plant as much as you can to offset it. I haven't found I have a big mouse problem where I'm growing, and I haven't found a really good way to deal with them rather than plant enough.
Plant enough. Okay, Bill, good luck to you. Let's see here. Lisa lives in a small apartment and wants to grow a few food plants in her small windows. Are there any that you recommend? She's looking for stuff she can grow indoors from start till harvest, maybe some spinach or mini tomatoes or some lettuce. Anybody with some advice for Lisa? We just have about a minute left.
I'd say herbs and let the others come back. There's some really good herbs you can grow and harvest and keep going, but I'm sure the other two have some ideas as well.
Yeah, I was going to say herbs, and you're right on the money with spinach and lettuce, any of those crops that kind of come through, you know, they don't take a long growing season. Tomatoes, if you have a big enough container, you could maybe do like a tomato, I would say, in like a 5 gallon bucket or something like that. But yeah, herbs and greens.
Okay. And Emily, you're nodding as well. Let's see here. I am going to go to a really quick question. No, I'm not. That's not quick. What I am going to say to the audience is if you were not able to get your question in today, please know that we will be doing several more gardening programs on Maine Calling as the season marches on. They're always popular. And as I said at the beginning of the show, always a good idea to call in at the beginning if possible. Thank you to all of our guests. With us today, Emily Basden, Seed Stewardship Director at the Wild Seed Project. Dr. David Handley is Vegetable and Small Fruit Specialist with the UMaine Cooperative Extension. And Jean Pauley is a librarian and youth programmer with the Ellsworth Library and an organic farmer. Today's sound engineer was Jessica Miller. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And if you want to find out every Friday what's coming up on Maine Calling next week, subscribe to the Maine Calling newsletter. It's free. You can do that at mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.